we're going through this series for the summer. We're going through a series that it's not the whole book of 2 Corinthians, but an extended section where, you know, we started at the end of chapter 2 with the whole the aroma of Christ. We'll by the end of August we'll finish chapter 5 and just talking about the themes of glory and frailty, how God shows the world his glory through our frailty, not through our kind of self-sufficiency. And this Sunday I'll be starting off the first 5 verses of chapter 5, and as I was going through it and reading the commentaries, I was just like, it seems like the kind of thing I'd want to talk to Randy about because of all your writing and everything. And I'm kind of like, all right, I kind of feel like I've got my bearings with this, but just that, you know, it's dealing with resurrection body, it's dealing with intermediate state and things like that. And
right.
As I've been thinking about it, I just wanted to see if I could kind of like bounce things off, see what your take is on some of the different questions about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, because one of them that's come up has been, you know, the whole, and it seems like at least very strong consensus with the commentaries I've read. And he says the whole thing about, you know, we don't want to be found naked. We don't want to be unclothed, but we want to be clothed. And then when you start getting into like verse 8, the whole thing of, you know, if we're away from the body, we're with the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consensus that I'm seeing seems to be like, all right, he's, you know, the thing that Paul is after is talking about the idea that what we want is not to be disembodied spirits. What we want is to be clothed with our new resurrection body.
Mm-hmm.
But that when he talks about the whole idea of being unclothed or being naked, that has to do with the intermediate state. And so trying to take in like, okay, and there is mystery surrounding this, but just the whole idea of, all right, if we're in this intermediate state and we're still awaiting our final resurrection, we haven't experienced the resurrection and the rejoining in our new resurrected body, of what's going on with us in this in-between state where the evidence points towards the idea that, yeah, we're conscious, we're aware and all of that. And I think we may have at some point had a conversation before about this, but do you have a take on sort of like, is there some sort of like intermediate physical body that you think is going on there, as opposed to sort of like, well, we're present, but we don't have a physical existence during the intermediate state?
Yeah, it is very intriguing. In fact, I have, when I wrote the first book where I really got into stuff related to the afterlife was a small book called In Light of Eternity, which I wrote years before I wrote the big heaven book. And I got myself into trouble with some readers because I proposed the possibility, and I made clear it was a possibility, of an intermediate, and I think in the first version I said an intermediate temporary body that would be a bridge for human beings to still be human. You know, if you have a while before the resurrection, because of course, if you take, you know, if you're heavily influenced by the whole Hellenistic thing, like the early church fathers, you had no need for that. The disembodied state was actually ideal for the Greeks. I mean, in their thinking, strangely, but for the Christian, clearly it's not. And Paul makes that so emphatically clear in 1 Corinthians 15. And then you have all of these pictures of believers in the presence of God, standing, walking, talking, kneeling, wearing crowns, casting the crowns in front of the Lord. There's even palm branches, carrying palm branches. Then you've got the tree of life that is there. And there's no indication that this is not the tree of life. I mean, when it's called the tree of life, you know, not a tree of life, one gets the definite impression that this was relocated from Eden after the fall to the heavenly state but it has physicality. We know that Christ has risen from the dead and that he is there in his, and there's even debate about this, whether he's there in his resurrection body or he's there in his glorified body. And some think of those as the same and some think of them as remarkably different. You know, the glorified body being the overwhelming one of Revelation 1, as opposed to the resurrection body being the one where the disciples were amazed, you know, at him. And Thomas, when he finally sees him, and, you know, and he's blown away by him, but it's not the same as when John is, I mean, the figure of Christ and the just the whole brightness of his appearance and all of that is different later. But in any case, I was trying to solve a problem, which I think is a problem on multiple levels, by proposing that, well, for sure our resurrection bodies are our old bodies raised, so it's not in any sense our old body. I mean, I don't envision in any way that God is doing something with our old body in heaven. That's obviously in the grave, you know, and still on earth and awaiting the resurrection. But to try to deal with those different passages, not having to take everything literally at all, but by the time you're done, you're going, well, you know what? If there is no physicality in heaven, I think it's virtually misleading for all of these passages to, you know, have the martyrs, you know, who are standing around and people are wearing white clothes. And I get that, symbolic, but it's like a wedding ring is symbolic and it's also a ring. You know, I mean, also real, you know.
For something to be symbolic doesn't mean that it's not also physical.
Right, exactly. So I propose that. Well, then the pushback was you are eliminating the need for the resurrection. And of course, I wasn't doing that. But what if the whole, because if God can just grant material forms, and does grant material forms, what's different about that of the resurrection? Well, of course, the resurrection would be your actual body. But at the same time, I got the point. And so I actually rewrote, that's one of the books that I have revised, to clarify, I mean, just to bend over backwards. I thought I'd made it clear, but I hadn't. But to bend over backwards and say, if this is true and this is purely speculation, but if it is true, in no way does it minimize or make unnecessary the resurrection, etc. In fact, maybe it couldn't even be a possibility without the certainty of the coming resurrection, and maybe it's sort of a foreshadowing of it or something. But again, if you go back to you know, the Genesis account and God taking, you know, making Adam's body and then breathing into him the breath of life, the human being is not a body which is this temporal shell that is like a hermit crab. It is an essential part of what makes a human being. To be created in the image of God involves not just the spiritual, but the physical, and you can't make that nice little division of the whole real person goes to be with the Lord, and that unreal part that was the shell of that person stays on earth. And that's not, of course, the Hebrew or biblical you know, concept. So that actually leads into the problem, the struggle I've always had with 2 Corinthians 5, because it really does. Okay, if 2 Corinthians, if the Bible taught one at a time resurrection, 2 Corinthians 5 would make perfect sense.
Right.
It would just put, but it doesn't teach that. I mean, you've got John 5 and John 6 and, you know, the resurrection and the resurrection to life, resurrection and this in that hour, on that day, that future day. And you've got 1 Thessalonians 4, and you've got all those passages. And it's not one at a time resurrection, but 2 Corinthians 5, on the surface, to me, sounds like when you die and go to be with the Lord, that it you're going to have a body when you're there. I don't know. I know, how are you, as you see it, how are you avoiding that problem and the whole nakedness thing and, you know, that whole
thing? Yeah, well, I think, you know, and it is hard because, of course, we don't want to read scripture in isolation, but I have kind of thought about that where I'm like, okay, if this was the whole
yes
of what I had, what would it, and I'm kind of like, I think I would be wavering between one of two possibilities. And the first would be that, well, I guess in some ways three, but maybe it's like, you know, two and a half. So the first would be that the one that you were just saying, that what he's saying is, okay, we are in this tent right now. That's our temporary body. We have a building from God. That's our resurrection body. When this tent is destroyed, we will get that resurrection body. And that when Paul is talking about the nakedness, he's saying that doesn't happen ever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you could. I feel like you could make that case.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you also could make the case that he's saying the nakedness does happen, but it's not our ultimate hope.
Right.
But even in the nakedness, we still are, we are present with the Lord, because when he says the whole, while we're here in the body, we're away from the Lord, but when we're absent with the body, from the body, we'll be present with the Lord. It's like you could take that to say he means when we're absent from this tent.
Right.
But not when we're, you know, but you could also take that to say, like, okay, he's saying during a period of time where we are going to be in that nakedness, which is not what we ultimately want, it still is, you know, it goes along with the Philippians 1, you know,
right.
It's much better by far, all of that.
Better by far, but that doesn't mean
yeah.
the best it will ever be, because that
exactly.
will be
yeah.
after the resurrection. Yeah.
Yeah, because I feel like even with the Philippians 1 passage, the only way that would work to not be talking about an intermediate state is if you believe in soul sleep,
right.
you believe, which to me would be like, that's the two and a half option there.
Yes.
You're like, well, there will be a time gap, certainly, for people who die, but we're not going to even be aware of it. You know,
right.
we'll die, and the next thing we know, we'll be resurrected.
Right.
Which, scripturally, I'm kind of like, I don't think that it's impossible. I just think it's so highly unlikely that, to me, it's not an option that I would ever go with. It's like, I wouldn't call it a heresy. I'm like, you can make a case for it, but you've really got to then look at the Revelation passages. And, you know, I mean, people have different takes on the whole, the rich man and Lazarus, of course, but it's like,
right.
you got to take a bunch of these passages and say, like, these are purely communicating ideas. These are not meant to be taken literally in any way whatsoever.
Right.
There aren't actually all these people worshiping before the throne right now. That's just, you know, communicating a concept, which,
right.
again, I'd say it's not impossible, but it's a bridge too far for me to think that that's what's going
right.
on.
Right. Yeah.
To me, I'm kind of like, well, what, with all the data, I'm like, okay, like I, you know, if he had stopped without going into verse 8, where he says the whole thing about being absent from the body, being present
right.
with the Lord, then I would think, oh, all he's saying there's no period of time where we're ever sort of disembodied or whatever it is that is included in being naked. You know,
right.
During that, like, he's saying, we don't want that, and by the way, that won't happen. But when he gets into verses 6, 7, and 8, it seems like, oh, he might be saying, no, this does happen.
The, right, yes. Yeah, and I think that is the, I think when you take all of Scripture and put it together, that's almost what you have to come up with. I mean, what's
right.
the alternative? I mean, as you say, I mean, the other alternatives just are, I mean, certainly one at a time resurrection seems just contradictory
yeah.
To what Jesus said at least a few times and what Paul says and, you know, and even just the whole the resurrection and final judgment of Revelation 20 and all of that. So yeah, I mean, I think it is the best solution there is. It just there's just a part of me that goes, well, why don't you make it a little more clear what you mean by the nakedness, are you really saying there will be nakedness, or is your point there won't be?
You definitely could see a case for either one in there.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, that.
Yeah. When you were doing research for the different books, did you feel like you landed on sort of like a over the years, or even with the like early kind of church scholars, any kind of consensus on the whole question of, you know, first of all, is there a consistent witness that there was the belief that we were conscious during the intermediate state? And then was there any kind of consensus on we're embodied in some ways or we're totally disembodied? Like, were those things that there's any kind of...
I think the consciousness was a fairly clear consensus, even though there are indeed... I don't remember who, but some church fathers that the sleep was taken as sleep, unconscious sort of sleep. That makes it pretty difficult though, when you think about Jesus saying that Lazarus was asleep, you know, and that, because very clearly that was a euphemism for death. So when you know that sleep has been used by the Lord himself as a euphemism for death, then it's no stretch at all when Paul is using it, those who are asleep, you know. And so it, it's the appearance, the dead person looks like they're asleep, you know, other than, and to us, we define death as, the absence of these vital signs or whatever. But to the average person back then, you could just look. And you would go, if somebody's laying still, they're either dead or asleep. And so you can say sleep as a natural euphemism for death. And so I think that was pretty widely accepted. And then I think everybody was aware of today you shall be with me in paradise. And what could that possibly mean to be absent bodies, to be present with the Lord? And even better by far to die and be with Christ. Well, how would it be better if you weren't aware of its betterness? I mean, in what sense would it be better? I mean, isn't it better a perceived reality? But I think on the other, what was the other component of what you were asking?
The embodiment question.
Right.
In the intermediate state.
Yeah, that is not a consensus, definitely. Okay. In fact, I was finding myself sort of stretching to find people back then, and back then would have been in the 90s when I wrote that first book, to try to find people who were proposing some intermediate type of form and body. I think a lot of the church fathers, for instance, and then I think the reformers didn't seem to deal with it much, as I recall. And actually, you know, what would be great, and I haven't done this. I have read through Greg Allison's historical theology to show the progress of theology in these different realms of heaven. Of the new earth. I can't remember if he has if that's all in the same chapter where he deals with intermediate state, but he might have a separate one. But that would be interesting, because that's exactly the kind of thing that he deals with in historical theology is, okay, we know what different ones of us believe today. We know what the Bible says, but what did everybody in between think, you know?
Right, exactly.
Then that is valuable. But you saying that makes me think I need to go back and check that out. But the thing that struck me was you just can't. It's just kind of like what you were saying. I think with all of these passages, including the rich man and Lazarus, you can say, yeah, it's a parable. I get it. So don't make the parable walk on all fours. But you know what? When the parables, the guy's sowing seed in the field. Well, people sow seeds in fields. And it's actually seeds, and it's actually fields.
There's a connection to reality.
Yes, there is a connection to reality. And furthermore, Lazarus is the only person named in a parable. I mean, right. So, and then you go, it can't be a made-up name. Why? Because you would never make up the name Lazarus, because all you're going to do is confuse people because of the other Lazarus. You know? I mean, and especially the other Lazarus who died, you know?
Yeah, who died. Yeah.
And it's like, what? I mean, you would, it's almost, to me, it's almost like, okay, if Jesus is going to make up a name, it would seem to me that that would be a very unlikely name for him to make up. So part of me just says that Lazarus was a common name and that, you know, that there really was a man named Lazarus. Why does he not, you know, name the rich man? I don't know. I mean, you know, because it's not Dives or however that's pronounced. It's just
right,
it's
right.
Just rich. The rich, you know, that's just the Greek word carried over or whatever.
Yeah,
but
it's later.
Yeah, but the point is that there's just too much to that story. And even if he did make it up, and there wasn't really a man named Lazarus that this was about. When you get into details of dip your finger in water and cool
right.
my tongue, I mean, and it says the rich man is in agony, and you've got certain things that it's not just the rich man talking, it's certain things that Abraham says. Lazarus doesn't say anything, but to me, it's like, all right, if the point of the parable is to teach a lesson, if the only lesson is it will matter in the afterlife whether you have cared for the poor and needy, it just seems to me that the detail of picturing the afterlife is potentially pretty misleading if there's no basis for it.
Right, right.
So that to me then does have some substantial effect on my thinking, where I go, you know, how are people enjoying pleasure in heaven if it's not if there's not some physicality to it?
Yeah.
Is it possible for a disembodied spirit to experience a non-physical pleasure? Well, I mean, we can say we experience non-physical pleasures, you know. We have a satisfaction, the love that's in our heart, you know. It's nice to hug them, and that's physical, but even if we couldn't hug, could we retain the sense, especially having had a body and remembering what it was to have a body? And so I could go for a stretch and say, all right, we could be disembodied, but then again, you've got all those pictures, including the being clothed and all that. So to me, it just sort of makes sense. And then you could even look at 2 Corinthians 5 and say, if there were, and I'm not saying there is, but if there were an intermediate body, you could almost see a temporarily speaking, that 2 Corinthians 5 could mean what it at first glance to me appears to me, that there could be a brief nakedness that might be the transition over to, I mean, like, for instance, when Lazarus was carried by the angels we're not told how long it was. You presume that it wasn't a long journey, and yet he was carried by angels. So, I mean, it would be no stretch to think of it as taking some time, and maybe, of course, he could have a temporary body, but the point is, angels are spirits, and they can take on bodies, but they don't have to take on bodies. So, and in Daniel 9 and 10, you have a real angels described in battle and in very physical terms, but were they embodied when those were happening, or can spirit beings do things that we could only understand in physical ways, but it's still real? Or did you have two spiritual, or if it's more than two, multiple spiritual beings carrying a spiritual being, a non-physical being, to this place. And once he's there, he's given a temporal form or whatever. And I even, when I rewrote that, I think I stopped using the word body. I just said a temporal form, you know, just a physical form of some sort. So I don't even want to use the term body because it sounds like right. I'm talking about resurrection, which I'm really not. So, yeah, so for me, even though I don't recall coming across many people who, like, took literally the references in Revelation. I mean, you know, the church fathers took the Gospels allegorically. So what are they going to do with the right. book of Revelation? You know, that's, yeah, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you mentioned, you know, earlier the whole idea of the, you know, the concept of an intermediate form that solves a problem, which I agree with. I'm kind of like, all right, I feel like if it's not that, you know, either way, you're going to have something that you're left with where you're like, all right, that brings up problems. But I feel like if we're saying no physical form at all, at the very least, you know, you have the problem of then needing to say, okay, what that means is that all these things that we see in Revelation, like, they're, you know, like, there's a lot of explaining and that needs to be done. I think if there's still consciousness, that helps with some of it. But if there's no physical form, it does lead to other questions. And so I'm kind of like, did, you know, you obviously were getting pushback on that. Did you come across other people saying, like, were other people just saying there's no form whatsoever, or were some making some other explanation of how we take these other passages that at least would indicate a reason to believe that there could be a form?
Yeah, the one, there was one pastor who was a missionary who was the primary person pushing back, but he was also sending letters to numbers of people to, you know, say, hey, you know, this is, he used the term heresy. And so to him, it was really a big deal. And his thing was, it's wooden literal interpretation. You're interpreting a parable, you're interpreting the book of Revelation, which is meant to be, you know, allegorical. And of course, parts of it are very, you know, non-literal. But you do begin to wonder when you have something that, well, like, for instance, could you take, I'm trying to remember, I think he might have leaned towards soul sleep, at least it was a possibility for him, thinking that that solved a lot of things. But then, you know, when you have the martyrs in Revelation 6, they've died, they're with the Lord,
right.
They're crying out, they're asking questions. How long before these people, you bring judgment on these
right.
people on the earth who killed us? And you're going, okay, if that is all figurative and really there's no consciousness in the intermediate state, isn't that misleading? I mean, wouldn't you think that a person could read that and go, oh, people are actually talking in heaven, and they're actually right now worshiping Jesus in heaven. So they're not asleep, you know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because I feel like where I'm at, I'm like, okay, like I feel like the consciousness thing, there's really good reason to land pretty confidently there.
Right.
You know, that's where I'm like, all right, you know, that's not a highly controversial thing. Some people are going to see it differently, but that seems like real good reason to land there. But for me, I'm kind of like, well, I'm more than happy to take a more, you know, sort of like, hey, we don't know approach with the whole physical form idea. But it is one of those weird things where I'm like, you know, I see the problems that go along with saying that there is a temporary physical form, but I also just feel like there may be some unacknowledged problems that go along with ruling it out, because you do, like you said, I mean, with the martyrs are crying out, they're given a rope.
And, yeah.
So it's like, okay, you know, and I'm like, I'm willing to go a long way with the symbolism thing, but we just, when we have these consistent presentations, and when you just get into, you know, the thing that's like, it's not that you can't overcome this, but when you do think about, like, gosh, to be human really seems yes. like it is body and spirit. Now, that may be why Paul is making a big deal about the nakedness thing, where he's right. like, yeah, this is, you know, he's willing to go so far, you know, he mentions it in a way that seems to be derogatory in verse 3, but if he's talking about the same thing when he gets to verse 8, he's not talking that, you know, one of the commentators I was reading was just sort of bringing up that Paul is, that Paul seems to be communicating sort of both. He, you know, some, and you know this better than anyone, that, you know, a lot of people will talk about sort of like, well, you know, when we die, we go to heaven, and like, full stop, like, right. That's all we're hoping for.
Yep.
And Paul's making real clear that's not the case. You know, he's like, and because if he is talking about the disembodied state there, he talks about it positively, but also negatively. Like, this isn't what we ultimately want. We want to be reclothed or clothed over. So it just seems like, all right, well, it's possible that it is a disembodied state. God can do that, and we could not understand it. And I would just have to kind of be like, I don't know, like, but... Yeah, but I don't know. Like, God is more than capable of doing something there where we're conscious and we're aware that we're participating with Him and we're right. experiencing comfort, and it's much better by far. But when you actually spend, like, conscious time trying to think about what it would be like, it's pretty hard
to yeah.
like, conceptualize that.
Well, and I think even the very definition of a human being, if we... I think the reason that the disembodied state in eternity makes perfect and obvious sense to most people, and there's really no issue with it, is precisely because of our influence, the influence of Greek theology. You know, it's right. just, of course, that makes perfect sense. And then when you look at how repugnant it actually is to Paul in 1 Corinthians 15,
right.
it's like, what? I mean, if the dead are not raised, of course, you know, you can look at that a different way. But nonetheless, you know, we're of all men most to be pitied. Well, obviously he's talking about, you know, there must be matters of eternal destination. But, I mean, it does not, it sounds like the whole idea of what here may be referred to with the nakedness is to Paul something extremely undesirable. And if it's undesirable in the long haul, is it not in some sense undesirable in the short run too? You know? Right. And so I did remember when I was writing my book, We Shall See God, with on Spurgeon, to be able to I found a message that he preached about the saints in heaven awaiting their resurrection and just looking forward to, which is great, because to me, I don't, when you say better by far, again, it's not saying it's the best it will ever be in all eternity.
Right.
But to most people, it is saying that. I mean, it is saying yes. that. I mean, it will never get better. Then one moment after you die and you see Jesus and you're with him, it doesn't get any better than that. Well, the resurrection is apparently better than that, or it yeah. wouldn't be dealt with the way it is in 1 Corinthians 15 and in other passages as well. So one of the questions becomes, okay, so do humans go to heaven when they die? And then most people would say yes. And let's take... Even the soul sleep people would say that, but let's just say, let's take the consciousness aspect of it and take that for granted for a moment. Do sure. people go to heaven when they die? Well, of course they do. All right, then how are you defining a person? What is necessary to make a person? Well, clearly it's not a body. People don't need bodies to be people. I mean, in other words, if you say that's a human being, in a meaningful or even full sense, in heaven, then really, in some ways, the Greeks were right that the real person is the spirit, and that body that was left down on Earth was not the real person, or there's no physicality to the real human being. But that seems right. just to be contrary to what Genesis is saying, and the ultimate notion of resurrection. What's the need right. for the resurrection? It's to bring it back to what it's supposed to be, you know? So,
yeah.
So I, even that to me is a bit of a problem. But again, many of the things that I can think of as problems are obviously ultimately aren't problems. It's more of a matter of which interpretation, because this is what we always do. We, I think, you know, usually some interpretations, there's just no, I mean, it's just so obvious to everyone. But then there's other things where coming to the right interpretation, it's basically finding the one with the least amount of problems in relation to other passages of Scripture, you know. So, yeah, now here's another thing. Think of Jesus having a body in heaven. We know there is at least one physical body in heaven, the body of Jesus. Is he the only one until the resurrection? Or, you know, now, then you have the Moses and Elijah thing in the Transfiguration. And Elijah actually not dying, but being taken right. straight into heaven. And then Moses, the other one in the Transfiguration, having that, you know, God buried him. So he really did die. But then you got the Jude passage with Michael and the dispute about the body right. of Moses. Right. And you go, okay, something's weird happened related to the death of Moses, right? And then Elijah, something weird happened. And maybe he just didn't die, or maybe what we think of him as not dying is God just basically ended his life, you know, and took him into heaven ultimately once he got there. Or is it possible that when he comes down to earth in the Transfiguration, that he's coming down in the exact form he is in heaven right now?
Right, right.
And Moses has a form. So is it, they're just granted that form momentarily, like angels take on bodies and then right. shed or the bodies?
I mean, obviously the Samuel thing is very, you know, it's fraught with questions.
Right,
but
right.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Samuel thing also, where it's like, well, there was some form that Saul saw.
Right.
When all of that happened.
Right, and was it true to what Samuel had appeared on earth, or was it true to what Samuel looks like in heaven, or both? You know,
right.
Because maybe it's essentially the same. I mean, the rich man recognizes Lazarus,
right.
you know, and he and that's without any spiritual insight. And he recognizes Abraham, I guess, you know, or does Abraham identify? Yeah, he just recognizes him, I guess.
Abraham is wearing a name badge.
It's a name badge. Exactly. Or he had a poster on his wall of Abraham. And that's so, right. you know, he knew. So.
Okay. Yeah. No. That's actually real helpful. Just kind of being able to talk that through and see it, because I guess to some degree I had remembered, you know, either through reading your stuff or talking to you about the whole proposal of, you know, a temporary intermediate form, and had never given lots of thought to it, but was just kind of now dealing with this and being like, yeah, that is where that debate comes into play. And I don't mind, you know, I don't mind either my own personal beliefs or even saying to the congregation, like, hey, we're treading here in matters where we've got to hold real loosely to it.
Yeah.
You know, like we've got to really have some humility and say, there's not just an obvious solution to either of these problems that's going to exist if we either think
right.
that there's definitely no chance for any intermediate form, or if we think that there is an intermediate form, there's not this real clear path of how all that works.
Right. To me, it makes sense yes. to say, okay, like when people talk about, you know, somebody says to me, and Nancy's at a banquet right now and all that, I don't know that she will be eating, because I think of that as a reserve for the resurrection body, and maybe it's because
yeah.
Jesus ate in the resurrection body and all that. Now, I mean, so any But on the other hand, I don't push back when somebody says, I'll bet the moment Jesus saw Nancy, well, she probably fell on her knees first and all of that, but that he put his arms around her and hugged her, like that poster, you know, that of Jesus lifting that blonde girl into his arms and she's smiling and she's, obviously, if it's a disembodied state, Jesus is not hugging, has not hugged Nancy since she's been there, right? Because, I mean, you can't hug what's disembodied. You can't hug a spirit, right? Okay, so then there's a part of me that goes, is it only sentimental on my part that I can't imagine Nancy not, I mean, she could see without physical eyes. I mean, and even that is interesting. She could see. I mean, we know that angels can see, but they're spirits by nature, and they're spirits who can see. But are we spirits alone by nature? And so does even seeing and speaking, do the speaking passage, that could be a disembodied person speaking. Well, I mean, vocal cords, right? I mean, in other words, we just take that for granted because we've seen enough imaginary stuff, like a voice of a person who really isn't a person, you know, that they're not really there. They don't have a body. But I just wonder, I mean, when Nancy, when 1 Peter 1 talks about the rich welcome that we will receive, and that appears to be in the present heaven, not the, you know, is when somebody first comes, the welcome to heaven, right. The rich welcome. Man, I just picture people surrounding and standing and maybe clapping and embracing and seeing your grandmother that you haven't seen and seeing your best friend that you haven't seen and me when I go to heaven and see Nancy. Well, she's disembodied. I won't be seeing her.
Right.
And that, again, that could all just be, well, those are only sentimental arguments. But there's a part of me that goes, but no, I think it's more than that, because it's true they are sentimental, but that doesn't mean they're only sentimental, because why am I wishing for all those things? Because I'm human. Because I know that physicality is part of my humanness, it's part of Nancy's humanness, and it's part of the humanness, the humanity of every person who's ever lived. And so are we really saying that people are in heaven, or are we saying there are those who used to be people and will one day again be people in heaven? They used to be when they were alive down here, and they will be again in the resurrection and in the millennium and the new earth. But right now, they're not human in the full sense. You know, and I just think, again, it's hard for me to get around. It works so well with the Greek concept. Of sure, they're fully human, and just like the hermit crab, they were taken out of a shell, and now they'll be put into a better shell for all eternity. You know, but that's not the doctrine of the resurrection.
Yeah, it's funny because, and I know this was one of your points, even when you were writing a lot of this stuff, that's sort of like there's a surprisingly low amount of attention given to these different questions and these different things, and especially in a culture like ours where we do sort of by de facto treat the idea of when we die, we are entering to our ultimate
right
final destination and hope. And then when, if we do get beyond that, if we realize, no, it's not true, we're hoping in the resurrection, then we're left bereft of a lot of clarity about, well, what is this intermediate state? And it's one right thing to have the humility to say, hey, there's a lot that we don't know, let's tread humbly, but it's another thing to dismiss something that is at least a potential explanation
right
of trying to make sense of something that's tricky.
Well, and you get a lot of pushback from people, I have in particular, because I've written, you know, 5 or 6 books on heaven, but I would say even pastors, when they talk about what may be true in heaven, right now, and what maybe should, and you'll do at least some of that in your message. But the problem is, pastors are constantly speculating on the basis of what we see in the text of Scripture, and then we go, the prodigal son, he ran toward his son, and in that culture, dignified people didn't run, and we know that's historical background, but we start speculate. I mean, when you're telling a biblical story, you almost never just restrict it to the exact words. You picture, okay, so Jesus is in this room with his disciples, and they're having this conversation. Can you just imagine what they're saying? And we don't go, oh no, don't use that word imagine. You have to fill in the blanks. I mean, people will criticize like biblical novels. You know, you got a novel on the life of David. I think they can be very helpful, just as long as you remember that. Yeah, night. I mean, it's night. It's not like 50% of it is speculation. It's like 99% of it is. I mean, if you just take there's a lot about David, but if you take a novel that's written about James and John, the Sons of Thunder. Ellen Gunderson Traylor wrote one years ago that I just love that novel. And it just like making the apostles then, come alive. Well, of course there's speculation. It's a novel. But the speculation hopefully is some of it anyway, it's solidly grounded on certain things we know to be true, where Jesus calls them the Sons of Thunder, and we know how they want to bring down fire, and we know, so we can say certain things in keeping with Scripture. And I think that's the way it is when we're speculating about heaven. We can go, okay, it's okay to speculate, but let's inform our speculation with actual biblical texts and the kind of the whole tenor of Scripture. And that's why I think, it always strikes me, and still strikes me, although not as much as it did when I first wrote the Heaven book, I think there's a lot more people thinking and talking about the New Earth now. I was listening to some messages online recently, and I remember years ago trying to find sermons on the New Earth. And it was like, I just could hardly find them, and even only some of the Reformed systematic theologies deal in any substantial way with the New Earth. Any dispensational leaning theology, and there's not a lot of them, but Chafer's systematic theology would be a primary example of it. It has, way more in the millennium than the New Earth. I mean, not even comparable. I mean, the millennium is like this. Okay, well, fine. I mean, I believe in a millennium, but it's only 1,000 years. We're going to live forever on the New Earth. And you have almost nothing about it. And I remember Burkhoff's systematic theology that has literally less on the New Earth. It's shorter than Revelation 21 and 22, what it has to say. And then you take what the Bible actually says about baptism and find like 90 pages of material on baptism, in the systematic theology. It's disproportionate. But I really do think on the whole New Earth and resurrection end of things, that we really do it such an injustice, because we leave people with this truncated theology where that's why they think heaven's going to be boring, because the only thing they know about is the present heaven. And all they've heard is, the disembodied state, and you can say, well, don't you believe in the resurrection? Well, yeah, of course they believe in the resurrection. They're Christians. But it's as if they don't believe in the resurrection because they never think about it. Yeah. They just think about where their loved ones are now. That's heaven, and they don't think in terms of heaven being relocated to the new earth, the new universe, new heavens and new earth, for eternity. And that's why you get people saying, and even Christian funerals, and I was at one where they're talking about, oh, and he loved golf so much, and he's up there playing golf right now. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I think playing golf on the new earth is completely feasible. Of course. I mean, I'm not saying it will happen. I'm just saying it could happen. Because there will be actual physical bodies with physical properties. People are eating and drinking. Can people run and jump? Can people hug each other? Can people play sports? Of course. There'd be no reason, not to. But in the present heaven, playing golf. And if what I'm saying about physicality there, that's possible. But that's the other thing, by the way. So you've got the picture of, you've got how the temple on earth in Hebrews, is designed after the temple in heaven. And so doesn't that suggest physicality in heaven now? And does that in Hebrews, where it talks about the city, the New Jerusalem, not in those terms, but the city, the heavenly city. And then when it says that is brought down to the earth, and that's the New Jerusalem, sounds like it's not being created for the first time on earth, but it's being relocated to the earth, which raises the question of, are there physical places in heaven right now? Can anyone touch that tree of life that's there, or is it just suspended and there's no ground because there's no physicality in heaven? And so Jesus is literally floating. He's not walking, right? I mean, he has a physical body, but and he could float, of course. He's the Son of God. He could have floated if he wanted to when he was down here. But it's just really hard to put that together from what you see of the present heaven. Anyway. Yeah.